Quaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is Friday, August 17th, 2012, and this is podcast number 189. And we're going to start off again today. Well, I say we, it's only me. Kai is going to be my co-host, my part-time co-host, Kai, is going to be on her way very shortly to Washington, D.C. To be a part of the big Lemonade Freedom Day celebration there in Washington, D.C. So as I've been doing quite a bit here lately, I'm going to give some information and some encouragement about the Lemonade Freedom Day that's happening tomorrow, Saturday, the 18th of August, and it's going to be in Washington, D.C., 3rd Street Southwest between Maryland and Jefferson near the Capitol Reflecting Pool. And if you're anywhere in the area of Washington, D.C., what you need to do is get over there, bring something to share, bring something to trade. It can be a food item, it can be anything. The idea is to voluntarily exchange stuff. That's the whole point, is to voluntarily exchange without permission, without permits, without asking the masters for anything. Show up there and be a part of it. Be a part of this. See, we're talking about property rights here. This is basic property rights. If individuals do not have the right to exchange freely, without government permission, without government interference, without overlords coming in and blessing our every activity, if we do not have the right to exchange among ourselves under voluntary circumstances, then this displays to the world that, in fact, we are not free, and America is not a free country, and we're not the freest place in the world and you know, the happiest land in all of Magic Kingdom. We are not. We are under an oppressive government that wants to micromanage what kind of milk you not only drink, not only what kind of milk you drink, but what kind of milk is produced, what kind of milk is transported, what kind of milk is bought and sold and possessed. These people in government and these people who support the government believe that it's right and that it's proper to send a SWAT team onto an Amish farmer's land and use that level of aggression because he has milk or cheese that is not government approved. This is the world we live in. This has to stop. And the only way this can stop is if the absurdity of it is brought to light in a way that can't be denied, that can't be looked around, so that people can't just pretend like we're free and go on singing their little patriotic songs, waving their little flags, pretending like we're free when we are absolutely not free. If we can't exchange milk and lemonade and other food items like this, then the entire concept of property rights means nothing. And that's the actual case. If, you know, the deeper you consider the existence of the state and the philosophical end of this, you begin to realize that the state, and this is not mine, this is Hans Hermann Hoppe portrays this beautifully in his book, Democracy, the God That Failed. But the whole concept of property rights is contrary to the concept of having a state. The two cannot exist in the same place in the same time. Well, okay, let me get back to my little commercial here on the thing for Saturday. We have finally got the attention of LouRockwell.com, and I'm thrilled about that. Kevin DeCoster, one of the writers for LouRockwell.com, put on Lou Rockwell's blog a shout-out to the activities there in Washington that are happening tomorrow. And I might also say, since this podcast, this is Friday's podcast, so it's going to be repeated at several different locations. It'll be repeated in a loop all through the weekend. So you may be hearing this actually Saturday, or you may be hearing this after the fact on Saturday, or after the fact on Sunday, or all the way in well into Monday until the next podcast posts on Monday. So, you know, if it's already past Saturday midday when you hear this podcast, and if you're not aware of what's going on, get on the internet and find out the update on this, because you know, it's kind of important. I mean, it really is. If you think about this, I said on Facebook, and I'll stand with this. I would hold to this in a debate. I said on Facebook that this event on Saturday the 18th in Washington, D.C. is the single most important liberty-oriented event of the year. It's more important than any Ron Paul rally that you've ever attended. It's more important than the stupid Republican convention that's happening down there in Florida. It's more important than the elections themselves, because none of those things are going to change. Nothing is going to change from the elections. Nothing is going to change from all these Republicans getting together down there in Florida and patting each other on the back and deciding who gets to lose to Obama. None of that's going to change anything. And I'm sorry for all the Ron Paul supporters out there, but every penny you gave to Ron Paul is not going to change the government. Even if it could change the government, it's still going to be, you know, by Bastiat's law, it can't be a positive change. Even if it looks like a positive change, if you gave money to Ron Paul and he was able to use that money in some way to make what appears to be a positive change in government, as Bastiat demonstrated so clearly, it's only an illusion of being good. In the long run, there's bad that's going to be produced, because that's all government can ever produce. So all of the rallies in the world of getting together and standing with Ron Paul and all of that is going to be overshadowed by how important this event is on Saturday. And with any luck, it looks like possibly CNN, quite likely Fox News, and a lot of other mainstream media is going to be taking a look at this. So this could really be important. And again, the reason why it's important is because it's displaying with great obviousness the absurdity of government. Now, how many speeches in a speech hall or on a college campus, how many of those really display the absurdity of government any better than having a cop handcuff a mother for handing a cup of lemonade to another person? Just think about that for a minute, because this is what happened at the last Lemonade Freedom Day in Washington, D.C. There's a floating around on YouTube, there's a really great video. I don't know if I can find it and link to it today or not. I'm going to have so many links on in the next 24 hours on Bad Quaker that it might get lost in the links anyway. But there's a YouTube video floating around on YouTube. A YouTube video on YouTube, imagine that. Anyway, it's from the last Lemonade Freedom Day in Washington, D.C., and it shows one of the ladies being handcuffed because she dared to pour a glass of lemonade, a cup of lemonade, and hand it to another lady that was there. And so the cops rush in to save the day because, you know, we can't have just wild, crazy people handing a cup of lemonade to another person. This is the kind of thing that we have to crack down on. You know, don't worry about, violence in the streets. Don't worry about, attacks of different kinds. Don't worry about muggers. Don't worry about robberies. Don't worry about car thefts. No, don't worry about those things. Somebody might be drinking lemonade that hasn't been approved by the government. Oh, no, we can't have that. And you see the absurdity of this. And yet there it is on the video, a woman being handcuffed by this big, powerful man, this cop. And then there's a question session after this where the cop is, you know, I'll say it. The cop is stupid enough to be honest and answer questions. Now, I'm sorry that may be rude, and somebody might hear that and say, oh, you shouldn't call people stupid. Well, when they're stupid, they should be called stupid. And this cop, unfortunately for him, and unfortunately for cops everywhere, his level of honesty met his level of stupidity, and he actually spoke the truth. one of the people there asks him, he says, you know, this is immoral what you're doing. And he says, I don't judge the morality of it. I'm just doing my job. I'm just, you know, whatever the law is, that's what I enforce. And they said, well, what about not very long ago when segregation was the law? And this is a black police officer that they're asking this to. And they asked the cop, a few years ago, segregation was the law. Would you have enforced that law? And he says, yes, I would have, because that's my job. I don't make the law, I just enforce it. Now, you know what? I was talking the other day about the difference in kind and difference in degree. If you heard that podcast, that's from, I think about last Tuesday. I think it was from last Tuesday the 14th, if I recall. And it's called something like Difference in Kind, Difference in Degree. And what I was talking about there it's an argument, it's used in argument, that is. You have two different things that are different in degree. So, for example, you have two different pans on a stove. They're both pans, they're both on the stove. One has heat underneath it, the other does not. So you have a very obvious thing here. You have something that is similar in kind, but different in degree. In other words, one's warmer than the other. Okay. But now, if you have an ostrich and you have a pan on the stove, and the ostrich and the pan on the stove are different in kind, so it's not correct, even if they're the same temperature, it's not correct to say that the ostrich is a pan, because they're quite different objects. They're different in kind, but they can be the same in degree. On the other hand, you can have two things that, well, I just did that, the two things that are the same, the two pans, they're same, but they're just different in degree. So now, compare this to what this cop is saying, that he would enforce the segregation laws because it's law, just simply because it's law and because it's his job. Well, what does that say about him as an individual? It says he has absolutely no morals. It doesn't matter that, you know, he's dumb enough to tell the truth. Well, that fell out of his big, dumb, empty head, sure. But the fact of the matter is, he has no morals. Otherwise, he wouldn't have a job, maintain a job, do a job every single day where he's doing something that is immoral, where he shuts off his own sense of right and wrong and just obeys. That is a horribly immoral position to find yourself in. And it's great that he said this, because the more cops come to a realization that that's what their job is. Their job, you know, they used to say this about soldiers, our job is not the reason why, our job is to do and die. Well, don't do that. Stop. Think about what you're doing. Especially if you're a cop and you're being told to inflict upon another human being an unjust law. Stop. Those people do not own you. Think about what you're doing. Think about what you're doing to humanity. Think about what you're doing to your own soul. But this cop, when he says that, and let me take this back to the argument of difference in kind and difference in degree. It's often quote, you know, when you're on the internet and somebody says, somebody says, well, I'm just doing my job, and it's like, well, that's what the Nazis said. Okay, now hold on. Immediately, people say, okay, well, that's hyperbole. You've jumped the shark there. You've gone into you've Godwinized the argument. Well, not really, because what we're talking about difference in degree, but it's the same kind. You see, someone who's willing to blindly obey orders, in spite of the fact that they know what's right and they know what's wrong, and they follow those orders anyway. This is exactly what I'm talking about with the difference in degree and similarity in kind. Your two pans sitting on the stove, one may be warmer than the other, but they're both pans, and one has the potential of being the same temperature as the other. All it takes is a turn of a knob, and it's there. And that's the situation with a cop who is willing to set his own morals aside and obey blindly whatever he's told. That person is absolutely no different in kind than the Nazi officer that draws his pistol places it on the back of a child's head, and pulls the trigger. There is no difference in kind. There is only a difference in degree. And that degree can change with the slightest tweaking of a knob by the hand of their master. The same brainwashing that took effect in Nazi Germany has happened in the United States, happened in the past tense. And we have uniformed individuals walking the streets today in the United States that would do exactly as they are told, and that is exactly what that cop says in this YouTube video. And again, I'll try to find it, but you know, I'm not sure about that. I just watched it this morning, so I know it's floating around out there. But what this cop said, as truth fell out of his big, dumb, empty head, revealed the fact that there is no difference in kind from the American cop who is willing to do his duty, who is willing to take his orders and obey his bosses. There is no difference in kind to the Nazi officer that draws his pistol and puts it on the back of a Jewish child's head and pulls the trigger. There is only a difference in degree. And that degree is simply one order away. And you say, no, they're not that bad. They're not. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And if you don't believe it, all you have to do is watch what happened to those people in Anaheim. It was no problem at all for police to execute multiple people that they had in custody. On the same weekend, was it two or three? I can't remember now. I think it was two. Two different people that the Anaheim police executed. Or I think one of them was attempting to run away or something, and they just shot him down like a dog. And why were they able to do that? Because they had already placed in their minds, those cops had already placed in their minds, the same mythology that inspired the Nazis, that there are some people that you can treat like this. And in the minds of those cops, those people are brown and they're suspected gang members. And if you're brown and you're a suspected gang member in Anaheim, it's perfectly okay in the minds of the cops to shoot you down. And if a family is on a yard, and if there's two or three families on a yard having something to say about the fact that the Anaheim cops are shooting people down, just executing them like that, then it's perfectly okay in the minds of the cop to load up a plastic bullet into his shotgun and blast into that crowd, or turn loose an attack dog on families in that crowd. People that are not in the streets, that are not marching, that are not being violent, that are simply on grass in a yard having a say about events that took place in their neighborhood. And that's justification to the police in Anaheim to draw their weapons and fire plastic bullets and turn loose an attack dog onto families. Now that's where we're at. And this has to be taken outside of just the thought that this is happening in Anaheim to brown people who might be gang members. This has to be taken outside of there, and people in America have to realize that this same exact thing is happening to a slightly lesser degree, but in same kind, to a slightly lesser degree to Amish farmers, to children who are trying to have a lemonade stand, to wives, to mothers. And each and every one of us has to ask ourselves, are we going to tolerate this? Will we? I'm going to take a break, and we're going to have a little commercial, and I'm going to breathe a little bit and try to calm down. Stick with me. I'll be right back.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Folks, I want to talk to you about survival gear bags. Survival gear bags is about more than just great gear bags and survival kits. Check out their website by clicking the banner at badquaker.com. Survival Gear Bags has everything from Wise food storage products to tactical equipment to camping supplies to clothing and rain gear to hydration and purification systems to books and DVDs. Plus, Survival Gear Bags is known for its service, and it's owned and operated by people who understand and adhere to the zero aggression principle. So get over to Survival Gear Bags and get the stuff you need. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial, and I've breathed a little bit. I'm a little calmer now, so maybe I can get through this without the level of anger that I was experiencing a moment ago. But keep in mind, you know, if you can't get angry about this, really, if you can't get angry about this, if you can't get angry about an Amish farmer being thrown to the ground and having a SWAT team trample his property, if that doesn't make you angry, if it doesn't make you angry that children are stopped from having a lemonade stand in their front yard by uniformed police, if that doesn't make you angry, I'm not sure what kind of a person you are. I've got a letter here that I want to read that came in from one of the listeners, and I really appreciate this letter. I'm not going to say the listener's name because I didn't ask permission ahead of time, so I'll just read the letter here. It says, "Hi, Ben. I listened to your Lemonade Freedom Day podcast," and a side note here, that was with Robert Fernandez. I had him on a couple weeks ago. He's the founder of Lemonade Freedom Day and one of the main people behind this this process here that we're talking about. Anyway, okay, so here's back to the letter. "Hi, Ben. I listened to your Lemonade Freedom Day podcast, which was great, but I couldn't help but thinking afterwards that there was something missing. I love the philosophy talk, but for folks who are new to libertarianism, it might be beneficial to throw out some of the more real-world examples of how government and corporations work in concert to destroy our rights and use us as their slaves. When the two of you were discussing government shutting down lemonade stands and the Amish farms, I thought about the revolving door between government, corporations, and the FDA, and how Secretary of Health and Human Services, Catherine, whatever her name is, I'm not going to try to pronounce her name, told the folks at Ground Zero, told the Ground Zero workers that the air was safe to breathe a couple days after 9/11. Now many of them are dying of respiratory diseases. People who are on the fence may respond more quickly to libertarian ideas if they were given concrete examples of statist propaganda and the consequences as opposed to just philosophy." And that's a great point. And Don, thanks for writing that to me. I saved this email for today. This was an email from back when I had Robert Fernandez on the podcast, but I saved it for today so that I could talk about it the day before the Lemonade Freedom Day for 2012. And this some great points in this letter. It is basically a revolving door. There are different memes, you know, floating around on the internet, pictures of like there's one that's really good. It's the circular chart that shows overlapping circles. And it shows like Monsanto executives and FDA bureaucrats. And it has the lists of names where Monsanto executives are actually also either currently or former FDA bureaucrats, and where FDA bureaucrats are either former or current Monsanto employees. And keeping in mind that Monsanto is regulated by the FDA. And it's not just Monsanto and FDA, or maybe it's not FDA for that one. I can't remember. You know, there's so many of those agencies that... But you get the concept, even if I got the wrong call letters. But it's the same thing with all these other things, too. You can see the same thing if you compare Goldman Sachs with the Treasury Department. If you compare Goldman Sachs with the organization, I can't remember what they're called, that regulates the trade on Wall Street and so forth like that. If you look at any of these governmental organizations that are in charge of controlling a particular industry, you will see that all of the decision makers in that governmental agency are either current or former employees within that industry. There are direct connections back to them, whether it be GE, Monsanto, Goldman Sachs, Boeing. It doesn't matter which one of these companies we're talking to. There is a direct connection. Employees, not just regular, not just hourly employees, sweeping the floor, whatever. We're talking about decision makers in high levels. And there's a complete marrying of these two organizations, all of the corporations that we're talking about here, and the regulatory bodies that control those corporations. And so one of the great threats to the state as a concept is the fact that you can look at this and see this connection between them. And as people begin to recognize this connection, then they start to understand that there is this huge conflict of interest, and that there's no possible way that these agencies of the government could be keeping corporations in check when the same people are actually running the corporations. This is a serious threat to the concept of the state. Once you start to understand this marriage between government and corporations. And so how is lemonade, or how is raw milk, or how is, unprocessed, unblessed butter that has not seen the blessing of the government, how is this a threat to this whole process? Well, it goes much deeper than this. If you read, James C. Scott has a book called The Art of Not Being Governed. And one of the aspects, it's not his main thing in there, but it's one of the major aspects that he covers, is the absolute need of the state to have slaves. Now, a lot of people, we're taught to think that the slaves were all set free long time ago, many generations ago, and hundreds of years ago, we don't have slavery anymore. But that's just a myth. It's a fogging of the situation. It's a fogging of reality by the lies, by the layers and layers of lies that the state puts upon us. Every state requires slaves. The state itself will not exist without slaves. You, who hear my voice, are a slave. In all likelihood, you cannot go where you want to go without the permission of the state. You cannot buy, sell what you want to buy and sell without the permission of the state. You cannot arm yourself and defend yourself as you would like. You may be given some leeway on any one of these little issues, but you don't have the full rights of a free person to go and to live your life the way you want, assuming you never bother anybody else, assuming you never lift your finger to harm another person. You are not free to come and go as you please, to arm yourself as you please, and to feed yourself as you please, because you're a slave. And this is critical to the existence of the state. The state has to have slaves. And the state uses food to control the slaves. It always has. Specific foods work better for the state's purposes. Foods like grains, for example. Grains have always been, since the beginning of the overproduction of grain, grain has been a method of controlling the slaves. And James C. Scott really goes into this in detail in The Art of Not Being Governed. Really lays the argument out to a degree that I don't know how anybody could even come up with an argument against James Scott's position on this. But it's not only grain. I've talked before about milk and the importance of milk in culture, and how milk is directly related to motherhood, and how it's foundational. Even the word itself is foundational to, if you just think of all these words come from the same origin: milk, mammal, mammary, mom, mother, mam. All these words come from the same origin, and they're critical to society, and yet each of them falls back to this word milk. And so why does the state need to control milk? Because of the psychological power involved. Milk itself comes from the state. You see that? If your bread comes from the state, and if your milk comes from the state, even if they don't bring it to you and hand it to you, it's blessed by the state, therefore it's okay. But if it's not blessed by the state, if you can get your milk and your bread, if you can get your sustenance without the blessings of the state, what does this do to the myth of the state? How well can the slaves be controlled if the milk and the bread can be obtained in some way other than through the blessings of the state? You see how important this is. I'm violating exactly what I talked about and what the suggestion of the email was. I'm going back to the philosophical side of it. The practical side, of course, is that that is why these organizations and why the government work hand in hand. If it dawns on people that you can get these things without the blessing of the state, and they're healthy without the blessing of the state, and they're safe without the blessing of the state, if that begins to dawn on people, and if you start to understand that, you know, you go to the grocery store, you go to the fresh foods department, you buy a bundle of spinach, and you buy some carrots, and you buy some peppers, and you buy some tomatoes, and you just assume all that stuff is, you know, clean and acceptable and healthy, and then you go home and you end up with salmonella over it. Well, it's some freak happening, right? No. This is what happens when a whole system trusts government inspectors, trusts layers and layers of bureaucrats to come up with rules, and then the assumption that people will follow all those rules. This creates a dangerous situation where the actual production and distribution of food is now given a false assurity by the government. And so people, without knowing really where their food comes from, people just believe blindly that the state has made sure that the food is good and they eat it. But if you absolutely knew where your food was coming from, if there was a farm that you could go to and get your food fresh from that farm, and then if that farm had the reputation of putting out bad food, you wouldn't go to that farm. But we don't have that with the state, with grocery stores, and with the whole industry that's wrapped around providing food for you. We don't have that. We don't have that market check in there. What we instead have is a lie from the government that they guarantee us that the food is good, and if it's not good, well, too bad, it wasn't good. You see, there's no assurance. Everything that appears to be an assurance is a lie from the government. And when people recognize that, and here's the threat to the state, when people recognize that the assurances of the government of clean food are nothing but a vapor, they're not real, it's just an imaginary thing, when people realize that, then they begin to question the whole process that the government provides for us. And keeping in mind now, this whole process is based on the fear that unapproved food might be bad. This whole layers and layers of bureaucracy of the government authorizing one food over another, all of this is based on the illogical and irrational fear that food that is not authorized by the government must somehow be bad for you. I've actually encountered this, you know, as a gardener raising food on my own and so forth. I've actually encountered the situation where a person looks at homegrown food and wonders, well, I don't know if that's safe. That didn't come from the grocery store. I don't know if that's safe. How odd that we would question our neighbor's garden, but we do not question the food in a giant chain grocery store that's set out on display by a person we don't know, that's unloaded from a truck by a person we don't know, that's transported in a truck driven by a person we don't know, that came through layers and layers of inspections, probably not actually on the food, probably more likely looking for drugs through the truck, and we don't know any of those inspectors. And maybe it was actually, maybe the food itself was actually inspected. More likely, there was an inspector standing around, you know, checking his iPod or whatever, well, you know, crates of food went by on a conveyor. That's more likely what was happening. But we don't even know that inspector. We don't know anything about that inspector. And it was loaded there from the farm onto some type of wagon or whatever, or truck or something, and hauled to that location by people we don't know. And it was raised by farmers maybe, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles away from us, that we have no way of even knowing who the farmer was. And yet we'll trust that whole system. From end to end, we'll trust that whole system just simply because it's got the state stamp of approval on it. But we worry about the guy down the street and around the corner, just outside of the city limits, who raises his own chickens and offers eggs for sale. We're like, I don't know about it, buying an egg from that guy. He's not a grocery store. He doesn't have hundreds or thousands of people handling those eggs. So I don't know if I'm going to trust him. How silly. How odd that we would believe such a thing. We will believe layers and layers of handlers who have no repercussion for their actions. But we don't trust the guy who lives down the street that raises chickens. And he eats those chickens and he eats the eggs from those chickens. So he has a direct interest in making sure that those eggs are healthy and those chickens are healthy. But we don't trust him. We trust this faceless organization of people that we call the government and their will and their actions and their intent. We trust all that. We trust the revolving door of government to corporations. We trust that whole process. We don't know any of those people. We don't know anything about them. We don't know what they do. Do they eat? Do those FDA inspectors, do they eat that kind of food? Or do they, you know, only go with locally grown? Or we don't know. We don't know. Because they're faceless bureaucrats far away. We don't know anything about them. And yet we trust them with our lives and with our children's lives. Who goes to the grocery store and buys fresh fruits and vegetables and brings them home and looks at them and goes, well, I don't know if this is safe or not? And who looks at those foods and goes, well, I assume it's safe. I bought it from the grocery store. And then they hand that apple to their child and let them eat that apple. Just like that. Do you know what is sprayed on potatoes to keep them from sprouting? Do you know? Do you know what is sprayed on potatoes that actually penetrates the skin of the potato and goes all the way down into the flesh that keeps that potato from sprouting? Do you know about this? But you trust and you eat because the government says it's okay. Is it? I'm going to break again for another commercial, and I'll be right back, and we'll wrap this up. I want to maybe wander away from this topic a little bit and talk a little bit about my interview with Kevin Gutzman, and maybe take the conversation in a slightly different direction. And yet not. Hi folks, Ben Stone here from BadQuaker.com. I want to tell you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, they have video files, audio files, and you can participate in discussions online and in the discussion boards. These audio files are in MP3 format, so you can download them and take them with you. You can listen to them on your drive to and from work or any time that's convenient for you. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes they don't get the real story in government-approved schools and government-approved history. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers, but it's also good for anybody who wants to learn about liberty while avoiding state propaganda. Take this course and Tom Woods and his team will equip you with one of the very best tools the liberty movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. Now, who else are you going to find at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom? Kevin Gutzman, the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, which is on my list of books, plus lots of other noted educators and students that will help guide you to your understanding of history and Austrian economics. So what is this kind of an education worth to you and your family? Well, at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for around $8 a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that will be added later in the future, the discussion forums, the optional live sessions, and reading suggestions. Now, how do you do this? Folks, go to badquaker.com. Click on the banner on the right-hand column where you see the ad for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. By using the link at badquaker.com, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. Now, before that last commercial, I made a comment about how, the government relies very much upon irrational fear, illogical fear, fear based on some of the most silly things, and yet the government entirely is based on these fears. Well, I shouldn't say entirely, but very close to it, very close to entirely, the myth of the state is based on fear of one kind or another. So the best way to keep slaves in control, and maybe that's offensive to some people to refer to, you know, to say, everybody under the foot of the state, everybody who can't come and go as they wish, everybody who can't arm themselves as they wish, everybody who can't engage in the kind of commerce that they want to engage in. If you're under any of these restraints, I'm sorry if it's offensive, but you're a slave. If you own property, you own real estate, I'm talking about land. If you own land and you think, well, I own this land, this is my land. Do you pay a yearly rent on that land to the government, to some level of the government? Do you pay for permission to stay on that land? And we can banty words, we can talk, we can call it tax, we can call it a property tax, we can whatever. It doesn't matter. If you stop paying that, they take it away. That means you didn't own it. You never owned it. What about this? Can you do whatever you want on your land? Can you, can you grow any plant that you decide you want to grow on your land? Most places you can't. Matter of fact, even simple plants, you know, most people don't realize, but there are government-controlled limitations on growing tobacco. That in the U.S. I don't know about other countries. If you try to grow tobacco on your land, now I'm not talking about one plant. You know, you can get away with growing one plant of a lot of forbidden things. But if you decide to be a tobacco farmer and grow a field of tobacco and sell it for a profit to try to make a living doing that, you have to have the government's permission, and you're only allowed to grow the amount of tobacco that the government gives you permission to grow. I don't know if most people realize that or not. That's the process in the United States of America, in the land of the free and home of the brave. Real brave, asking the government what you can grow on your own land. Real free. Real free to be able to travel from coast to coast and not be stopped and searched and hassled and asked questions and looked at funny. You can't do that. You can't do that in America. And why is that? Why is it that we are so afraid on so many levels that we tolerate this thing, this state? Why? Through layers and layers of fear that's placed upon us. From the earliest stages of our lives, we're told to fear strangers. We're told to fear what lies on the other side of the hill. We're told to fear those people. You know, there's an imaginary line on the ground. And we're told to fear those people that live on the other side of that imaginary line. Ooh, they're in that other country. We can't trust them. We have to have an army to provide us protection from those people on the other side of that imaginary line, because without an army to protect us from those people on the other side of that imaginary line, they're liable to cross that line. Oh no. What would happen if they crossed that line? Well, I don't know. I don't know, because I'm afraid of them, because they live on the other side of the line. You see, these fears are embedded into us from the earliest ages. When we're told in public schools that we're going to get out there and fight, and we're going to win this battle in football with the people from the other school, and we have to beat them because we're the Lions and they're the Tigers, or we're the Buccaneers and they're the Panthers, and we have to beat them because we're better than them, right? Their class, their school colors are green and blue. We can't be beat by the green and blue. We're the red and white. We can't have the green and blue beat us, right? We can't have Shelbyville beat us. No, those people in Shelbyville, they've got to be, they're weird. We can't have them. They're, you know, they're strangers. We can't trust them. We have to beat them in all of the levels of sports growing up so that we learn that people in other places can't be trusted. We have to be afraid of them. They're weird. They're different from us. Their skin's a different color. They talk different than us. They wear a different headgear than we do. We can't trust them. They're strangers. And the state embeds these fears into us and reinforces them over and over and over. You know, I was talking to Kevin Gutzman in the interview yesterday, and here's a guy who is really, really smart and very well respected in his field. And I'll just say this too, in the areas where Kevin and I disagree, and you might say, well, you know, he's not on the show to defend himself. Well, I'm not attacking him. That's not my point at all. I'm not going to attack Kevin. I have a lot of respect for Kevin, and I really appreciate the work that he's done, because without the work like Kevin has done and others, we wouldn't know a lot of the things that we rely upon. So I don't have to agree 100% with Kevin or anybody else to be able to utilize their services and appreciate the great things that they've done for us. You know, you can have an auto mechanic, and you can have an auto mechanic that you have a lot of trust in, and you realize, I can go to this one mechanic, and he will always find what's wrong with my car, and he will always fix it right the first time, and he will always charge me fairly. And that guy could be a communist. He could be anything. You don't know. You don't know what's going on in his private life. And it doesn't matter, because you're not going to him for governmental philosophy, or you're not going to him for, you know, whatever his oddities are. You're going to him because you can trust him as an auto mechanic to fix your car and to do it honestly. And so you go to him as an auto mechanic. So it's the same thing with a historian like Kevin. He's a historian. That's his specialty. And if I want to know something about Madison, and I was thrilled to have him on the show, and I can't wait to get his new book on Madison. But if I want to know something about Madison or about Jefferson or about the Constitution, here's a guy who has spent years studying it to the tiny little degree. And that's why when he came out with the position that he took on District of Columbia versus Heller, so many people were shocked. Because here's a guy who is not a gun grabber, and yet he's saying, look, if you're making this decision according to the Constitution, then the District of Columbia has the right, according to the Constitution, to not only regulate handguns, but to ban them completely, according to the Constitution. Washington, D.C. has that right to do that. Not only that, as a city, that is, not as a federal government. Not only that, but and I didn't have really the time to flesh this out with Kevin, but as Kevin would agree, according to the Constitution, if you really want to stick with the Constitution, then the state of California, or the state of New York, or the city of Chicago, or the city of New York, or any other entity that's below the federal level, all of those, right down to county, a parish that you might live in, or a township, whatever governing body that you might be under, if you're in the United States of America, the federal government is, according to the Constitution, this is not reality, by the way. Remember, Kevin agreed with me that the government doesn't even make any effort at all to stick with the Constitution. But if you had a government that stuck with the Constitution, going by exactly the way the Constitution is written, then any of those governmental agencies below the federal level could outlaw guns, and it would be strictly constitutional. It would be within the Constitution for any particular city, town, county, state to outlaw guns or to prevent free speech. Your free speech is not guaranteed by the Constitution, even, you know, in theory, if it worked at all, which it doesn't. But if we had a government that absolutely stuck with the Constitution, that would not guarantee your free speech from a city or from a county or from a state or from a parish or from a township. It only guarantees that the federal government can't interfere with your right to free speech. You see, that's the flaw of the Constitution, that is so deep in its creation that it makes it actually a tool of oppression, not a tool of liberty. If I ever have Kevin back on the show again, and I hope to, maybe we can get into more of the kind of conversation and the kind of question and answer that can flesh these things out, and we can really work on it. I wanted to get Kevin on, get him introduced to my audience, and get people comfortable with him. And I want my audience to know where I get my material for, you know, when I talk about the Constitution or when I talk about how the Constitution was brought about and these things like this. Kevin's books are a great source of this information, and that's one of the main places that I always look to. So I wanted to get him introduced to the audience, and I want the audience as much as possible. If you guys can get a hold of his books and read them, then you'll start to see where I'm coming from on many of these things. But that doesn't, you know, Kevin is like that mechanic. That doesn't mean everything that he does or says or thinks I agree with. But I strongly appreciate his grasp of history, and especially in the realm of the Constitution. Now, in that interview with Kevin, he said, I asked him specifically about anarchy, because I wanted to make sure that the audience understood that Kevin is not an anarchist at all. So I kind of allowed him to expand on his thoughts in that area. And he said, and this is a quote, he said, "I don't want to speak Mandarin. I don't want to go the way of Tibet. That's a case study in anarchy. The end result was that they are now a part of China." And I really had to hold my tongue, because I didn't bring Kevin on to debate him, and I didn't bring him on to throw I gotcha questions at him and then make him look like a fool, because Kevin is not a fool. He's a very intelligent individual that I have a lot of respect for. So if in the future, if I want to actually debate these issues with Kevin, I would invite him on in a way that he knew that there was going to be, not confrontation, because I have no desire to have a confrontation with Kevin, but if I were going to have that kind of conversation with Kevin, I would let him know ahead of time, look, I'd like to explore this and maybe look at my point of view on it and look at your point of view and see if we can come to some common ground and see if we can't maybe learn from each other a little bit. And if I brought the conversation in that way, then I would feel comfortable in talking to Kevin. But you being my audience, I can't let Kevin's words just fall to the ground like that. You have to remember something. Let's assume everything that Kevin said was correct, which I might have a problem with. But let's just assume that what he said was correct, that Tibet was indeed a case study in anarchy. It was not, but let's assume that. Let's assume that Tibet was a case study in anarchy, and that the end result was that Tibet is now a part of China. Well, it is a part of China. China militarily took over Tibet, and of course the Dalai Lama fled, as we all know, and is in exile at current. But here's a problem with that. If you go back, I mentioned James C. Scott earlier. If you go back and you read The Art of Not Being Governed, an anarchist history of upland Southeast Asia by James C. Scott, it's not an easy book to read. It's quite thick and slow, but it's extremely... it's documented in a way that you just have no room to object to James C. Scott's conclusions in it. And what James C. Scott shows very clearly is that literally for thousands of years, the people of upland Southeast Asia have lived in a completely stateless society. They have been anarchist for thousands of years. And the intrusion of the government of China into Tibet is really a small footnote on history. If you think about it, let's assume Kevin's argument is correct. Let's assume that Tibet was in a state of anarchy. And again, that's not chaos. Anarchy is not chaos. Chaos is chaos. Anarchy is anarchy. But let's assume that Tibet was in a condition of anarchy. And let's assume that this ended with the invasion of China, with the Chinese invasion, I should say. Well, then, so for 50 years, that anarchy has failed. But for thousands of years, that anarchy was successful because China couldn't invade. China could never, for years and years and thousands of years, China could not invade. And Tibet was free. So I think, you know, the minarchist who says, well, I want to reduce government as small as possible, and I would like to get rid of government, but I don't think I can because I need a government for this or I need a government for that. Even though I recognize that the government is evil, I have to put up with that tiny bit of evil in order to get these other things that I want, right? So it's a proportion matter. It's a matter of I'll take 2% of evil if I can have 98% good. See, that's what the minimalist, that's why he still wants to cling to the idea of a government. Because he thinks if we can keep that government as small as possible, down to that 2 or 5% or whatever, then the other 95 or 98% will be free. So proportionately speaking, I win if I have a minimalist government. Well, now take those same comparisons of percentage and look at the Tibet-China issue. Tibet was free, assuming the anarchy that's being placed upon it as a case study in Kevin's words, then Tibet was free for thousands of years and it has been a part of China, or a failure as anarchy. It's been a failure for 50 years, but it was a success for thousands of years. I think that's a if that's a case study in anarchy, that's a case study in success. But as James C. Scott shows in The Art of Not Being Governed, all of the land that he calls Zomia, the whole of this upland Southeast Asia, has always been in a situation of statelessness. And the people there, with complex societies, complex functional societies, with laws, and with methods of enforcing laws, with all the things that come with society, the people of upland Southeast Asia, the people of Zomia, have been stateless and are today. Approximately 100 million people in upland Southeast Asia and Zomia that are stateless today. 100 million people live in anarchy in a stateless condition in Zomia today. And they are not savages falling upon each other, eating each other, tearing each other apart. They're not doing that. They have a complex society. They have unique languages. They have all the things that we recognize as a part of a civilization, except they don't live under the heel of the state. Now, there are lines drawn on maps, and there are people who pretend that those areas belong to one country or another country. And as each day goes by, the power of the governments of those countries inflicts more and more of its oppression upon the people of Zomia. But the fact remains that today, in 2012, still 100 million stateless people live in Zomia and function. I'm pretty sure that's a case study in success. That's a case study in anarchy that proves success. But what is it? What is it that causes a person to say, no, but we have to have the government, we have to have them? It's fear. It's that illogical, unfounded fear that without the state, this would happen, or that would happen, or we wouldn't have this, or we wouldn't have that. Or those other people on the other side of that imaginary line would come and try to take away our freedoms. Well, you don't have any freedoms. You have permission. You don't have freedom. Unless you're living in Zomia, listening to my voice, if you live in Zomia, then you have freedom. There's a few places left in the earth, very few, where there are stateless people living in peace and in harmony with each other. There are a few places, and they're not savages. They're not, you know, half monkeys hanging from trees. These are people with cell phones. These are people that live in houses without a state. They function. They move around, they buy, they sell, they have money, they do things with no state. Today, as we are right now, a study in anarchy. It's not a failure, an absolute success. They're there. You can check them out for yourself. Read that book, James C. Scott, The Art of Not Being Governed. Pick it up. Take your time. It's a thick book. It's not an easy read. You'll see what I'm talking about. Folks, for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening.